So we can continue meditating as we listen. So receiving the sound without trying to create any busyness around it. Just relaxing around the sound that we hear when someone's speaking. Find all the stress and the tension comes when we entangle ourselves with what we're hearing, when the defilements come to play with, aversion or greed or creating a self, trying to be somebody. And this is what we find, isn't it, when we say, oh, when we're with a crowd. You come back, so I feel so tired afterwards, or feeling so restless. And that's because how we've processed the sense experience rather than the sense experience itself. We've let the defilements take over and run the show and create the energy, the what you call the vipaka kamma, the resultant. Is because the defilements have been operating rather than just being present. And so without us realizing, the subtle, clinging and pushing away or, identifying, all that's constantly sort of operating. And so when the sense impingement is a lot, there is a lot of that operating because there's a lot for it to get entangled with, which is why when we come to like a quiet space, the sense experience is cut out. Then the defilements have not much to kind of entangle themselves with. So it's easier to sort of calm the mind. And so we close eyes, we stop talking, we dim the lights even, and go to a quiet space, we say. So it's easier, and we can quieten the mind. But and what happens then is the defilements are almost suppressed or quietened, like shh, hush, hush now. So there's almost like the little kittens and the puppies gone to sleep, but they're still there. It only has to be a little, I don't know, little bell or a piece of meat, and they're boom, back again. So once the mind is quiet, we need to look at these defilements that are lurking there in the background. And like we said before, we have to release them, open the gates and let them run away, set them free. But we can see them when the space is clear. When the space is not clear, we think we are them. We think we are the puppy and the kid, the dog, and whatever. We become them, We are manifested in that. So how can we see them? So it's good to quieten the mind and but then also to be aware of that contrast of the peace that we have and the mind that is not so peaceful, so you can recognize it, and okay, there's something is not. It's not right here, or I can think a desire or craving or an aversion or sense of self is operating. I'm going in the wrong direction. The mind doesn't feel very wholesome or clear, or sometimes you find you feel very cloudy or completely absorbed and lost and. So get to know that mind as well, so you recognize it, and then to also savor and recognize the mind that's very, very peaceful, and that's, that's let go and calm, and the freedom that you get with that mind. And we need to remember that feeling, and then we can, when the mind is not that, we can. Because what happens with the defilements, they can be very strong, and they can be strong habits, or the allure of it could be very tempting. And so you want to chase it, or you want to run away from, whatever. And it can be a powerful force. But if we can observe how the mind feels in that push and pull, the desirable object becomes to feel less desirable, because we can see for ourselves, oh, this mind doesn't, it's not very pleasant. This is they're telling me that, having 3 cups of ice cream is going to be really great. But how that mind feels with the greed, I mean, that's a very innocent example. How the mind feels when you have that desire in you, and then comparing it to the mind, say, after it's very peaceful, letting go. You say, oh, do I? You could question for yourself about, is that really going to bring me so much joy? I'm not feeling that sense of peace and a calmness that I have through letting go, or the practice of seeing and mindfulness and compassion. This here, this it's that it's not so pleasant, but the defilements are so strong, saying, oh, this is really lovely, this is amazing, you must get it. But if you really have contemplated and connected with the peace of letting go, you begin to see the suffering of greed and aversion, and your sense of self, let's say winning something or winning the argument, that feeling of, this is not very pleasant. And actually, when you let go, and sometimes even letting go and accepting being misunderstood, being accepting of being, told that you were wrong when you thought you were right, that relinquishment is far more peaceful. And if you tasted that the feeling of it, you go, oh yeah, I'd rather do that or choose that. And then Dhamma is such that things will move in the right direction. Desire moves us in the wrong direction. Ajahn Amaru uses this wonderful tagline called "Desire is a liar." So it will tell us that it's great for you, it's good for you. You are right. They are wrong, and this is the best thing that you can do for yourself. Or you must run away from this situation. This is awful. And you have to be aware of those thoughts. And I think for me, mostly the feeling. If you start to connect with that feeling and start to kind of question it, like we were saying, are you sure? Is that so? And also the suffering. For me, that mind is very, very clouded, very confusing, and not pleasant. And clearly, there's no clarity. When the mind is filled with desire, wanting something or not wanting, there's no clarity. He's very confused. And that's a strong signal for me that I'm in the wrong, my mind is not seeing things clearly. And then you can't sort of choose to, okay, it's confused. Now let's have clarity. It's not like a, it's not, you can't kind of shift gear like that so quickly. Because if you're already there, the glass is already broken, you've got to then, okay, accept the situation and then stay with the smoke, You've got to stay with the broken pieces. You've got to stay with the cloud, the confusion. And then stay with it for a bit and stay with it. And then just, over time, allow it will shift. It's not pushing it away either. And then gently kind of moving our direction in the right way. Reading these suttas and contemplating is very helpful because sometimes I've had this feeling of like, oh, no, not jumping in there. That is fire. Desire is telling me, go there. But then you look there and you can contemplate. It's one way because desire sometimes, or aversion even, it's so deluding that you can't really see because a force is so powerful. But if you contemplate the consequences, that's helpful too. What's the consequence of me following this desire? All the possibilities that the mind doesn't see. That's what Ajahn Jayasaro was saying. When you have mindfulness, you can see all the, you can see the whole scenario. When you're just following that one thing, you can only see one thing that might not even be correct, and it's probably is wrong, the desire. So you stand back and then you take a moment to reflect, okay, where is this desire going to take me? What no going to go? What are the consequences of this? Because otherwise people, would be driven by desire, you can harm people, you can harm yourself, and people can break the precepts, or you end up suffering. That's the more kind of extreme example. But even in the small desires, if we start to let see and let go, you can find you get more and more peace, because every little drop of desire, following craving, adds a little drop of stress and restlessness, discontent. And just like every drop of Dhamma, little by little, gives us more peace and clarity and calmness. So we need to sort of be aware of that, and that we are filling our tank with the right little drops of water. Just thinking, so what we've spoken about is we've spoken about contemplate. All of this is a contemplation. The practice involves a lot of contemplation. It's called a contemplative path. So it's not, within inverted commas, just meditation, sitting and calming the mind, but it's also a lot of reflection, like we've been sharing today. We were reflecting about investigating non-self, looking at the broken world, impermanence, not sure, and then connecting with that peace, and then looking at how the desire works, how craving works, how the defilements work, and then setting them free. And this another one to contemplate is, so out of the three characteristics we spoke about, non-self, so anatta, and anicca dukkha anatta. So anicca is impermanent, seeing that this world is broken. And anatta is non-self. We touched upon it briefly. There is the gross sense of self, and there's a subtle sense of self. So the gross sense of self is what we let go, and say, and a path of enlightenment, a stream entry of, identifying as, at a gross level of, let's say, physically, man, woman, job, that are conventional characteristics that we identify. Then closer to enlightenment is when you completely let go of the subtle sense of self, of that there being, so the sense of I, or person being here, experiencing this, seeing this. So the sense of self in the more of a mental level. So the contemplation of sort of questioning who is experiencing, who this body belongs to, and this is quite helpful. And the other one, the three characteristics, or third one, is dukkha. Why are we talking about these three? You see, the three characteristics of existence, and the Buddha said this: if you see one of these three, then that's the door to the deathless, that's the door to enlightenment. So it's not like you have to see, you do not have to see, because if you see one of them, you see the other two at the same time. So if you see non-self, you will see that the world is broken and it is suffering. If you see that the world is broken, you will see that there is no self there and it is suffering. And if you really see suffering, you will see that really don't want to be part of this world. It is broken. So you can see those are the three doors, but you only have to peek through one of them. So I think it depends on everyone's character. Different people are connect with one of the three. Some people are more inclined to contemplating non-self. Some people impermanent. Some people suffering. I'm not quite. I think for me, my practice in different times, it's been a different thing. I think for a long time, I was contemplating impermanence and I guess suffering. Yeah, and then non-self. So suffering. I mean, suffering is probably what most, almost all of us got here. Suffering. And I was just speaking to Sarah yesterday. Because sometimes we see, oh, these people look very happy, they got perfect life and all that. Like, oh, I'm suffering. It's like, no, it's great. It's great we're suffering. Because the people with the perfect lives, they don't, they haven't, because of that, there has been no need for them to search for something else, because why would they need to? Because everything is perfect. Or it's not perfect, and they kind of replace it with something else, to distract, do another hobby, or get something else, or make another friend, or get married again, something to replace it, so that they haven't had to kind of endure the suffering, and to question and contemplate, oh, is this life like this? So and then find a true freedom from it. So, and as I was saying earlier as well, that actually when the world breaks apart and the carpet comes off your feet, I mean, that's where for us Dhamma practitioners, we can really, it takes us back into being in the present moment and investigating and to open up another door. Suffering is a first noble truth as well. The Buddha said, you need to understand suffering. And he said, "What I teach you, suffering and the end of suffering." So that's kind of what we were saying with understanding when the defilements are playing in the mind and when it's not there. That's the end of suffering, and the suffering. So in the Dhammacakka Sutta, the Buddha has given sort of examples of where we find suffering. Being with people we don't like, having to let go of people we like, or falling sick, dying, getting old. And then he said, identifying with our very existence, this body and mind, all that is suffering. And it's the contemplation of suffering leads to a disenchantment, a dispassion. It's not to lead to depression. It's to lead to, wow, is this what this world is? Sort of feeling. And so that your heart moves in a different direction. And I was reading this story of a monk called Mahakasapa. He was the Buddha's one of the, was that you could say, if you had to put top three monks of the Buddha's time. He was probably third, top three. So there was Sariputta and Moggallana, and number three was Mahakasapa. He was the foremost in austere practice. But apparently he got enlightened within 7 days. So I thought, what austere practice did you do for 7 days? But then reflecting on it further, he'd probably been practicing austere practices, you know, for many, many lifetimes, and also before he became a monk, austerity. So that was his sort of his thing, so to say. And then after he became enlightened, he still carried on just to inspire the younger generation. And also, I think he was so used to that way of being, he didn't want any new robes. So Mahakasapa was practicing these austerities and trying to, I suppose, figure out the dukkha in this existence. And the Buddha gave him advice when he first ordained. He told him three things. One was to keep his virtue and sort of be in a way that, you know, you're okay with the other monks, and, you know, so your behavior. And the second one was to listen to wholesome teachings, take it into your heart, and then apply it. And the third thing was mindfulness of the body with gladness, to practice mindfulness of the body with gladness. So those are the three things the Buddha told him. Makes sense, isn't it? Virtue, we know virtue. And then we were talking about factors for stream entry was, you know, listening to Dhamma, discussing Dhamma, and practicing Dhamma according to Dhamma. You know. And then the first one, you know, with the companions or the spiritual friends. And then third one was some mindfulness of the body with gladness. That was interesting. So coming to talking about contemplating suffering, it shouldn't lead to depression. So the Buddha said mindfulness of the body with gladness. It's interesting when I was on this retreat the last couple of weeks, I was contemplating the body, and then half sometimes I contemplate the body, I get this memory of a dana. Because there was a nun staying at my house while I was here, and suddenly the thought came, oh, there's a nun in my house, and then people are giving her dana, and it brought me so much gladness and joy, and I thought, oh good, this is balancing my mindfulness of the body that I'm doing, this sort of joy that's coming up, contemplating giving, and I think so that's sort of the balance we need to keep when we're contemplating the body or contemplating dukkha. So we need to be aware so that we are not sort of, you know, going into depression or despair. The Buddha told him, so mindfulness of the body, it's, I suppose, not just a physical body, because all the feelings and you find out all your emotions and trapped things are all you can sense and feel in the body. Connecting with the body is, it's really quite vital. I've done quite a bit of mindfulness of the body, because for those of you not aware, I work as a doctor, so I've really, you know, constantly exposed to the people's bodies and what happens to them, and gonna studied it for so many years. And so I sort of have a natural inclination towards it. If you really do contemplate, there is a lot of suffering in this body, and we try to pretend it's not so, but really opening up to what this body is really like. The key is dispassion and disenchantment. But I know for some people it can be, you know, so you have to balance it. You need to see, oh, is this leading to depression, or am I getting fearful, or what? If that's the case, you know, stop it there and, you know, think of something amazing you've done and bring some joy to hold the space, and then go back into, you know, contemplating the body. And this time on the retreat, for me, I was again really wanted to contemplate the body try to, because contemplation of the body is also helpful in letting go of desire, because a lot of desire reduces when you contemplate the body. So I was contemplating the body, and then I wondered, do I really know the body, or is it something because I learned, through intellect that I think I know the body? And this is quite a helpful thing to do in your meditation, because sometimes we've been talking about a lot about today about contemplation and how to contemplate. It takes you so far, and then you have to let go of the contemplation as well. So I give the analogy of making bread. So you've got all your ingredients, and you've kneaded the bread with everything, and you've done all the work, but it's not going to become bread until you let it go and put it in the oven, and then you have to completely trust in the oven to transform it into bread. So the med so as Ajahnamurti says, no analogy is perfect, so you could probably find a loophole in it, but this is also like that. So we contemplate all of these things, but then it comes to a point, you question, okay, so what is it really? And you let go. And so this is what I was doing with my body contemplation. I was thinking, okay, I contemplate the body a lot. Do I really know the body, or is this something I actually just learned, just through, seeing the body, studying about it? Or, have I really understood the body, as the Buddha says? And then so you pose the question. So you're in your meditation, and you can ask these questions, and you have to let go. So you say, okay, what is the body? What really is the body? And you have to go to this space of not knowing. You have to completely let go of any concept that And then it'll either come to you or it won't, and if you don't, you're like, okay, no, okay. And then you do more contemplation, you do the practice. But you have to at some point let go. And I think even that feeling of letting go comes when you are ready, because before then you are still sort of trying to find the answer. I think you have to exhaust yourself of trying to find the answer through contemplation, and the intellect. And it comes to a point where you're like, this is, I give up. It cannot get there. And then you then there's a complete letting go of the search. And then you pose the question, and then because you've truly given up, because it's not like, oh, I'm giving up, so then maybe the Buddha wisdom will come to me sort of desire. It's more true kind of surrendering to the Dhamma. And so in this instance, I was wondering, what is the body? And then there's also this thing about the fine in the Dhamma, they call about the gross body and the fine body. I don't know whether you've heard, there's the thing called a fine material realm. So this human realm is supposed to be a gross material realm, like, we've got these gross bodies, and there's supposed to be another realm where it's supposed to be fine material. So the body is very light, it's not very gross, like a Brahma realm, isn't it? Yeah. So I was wondering okay, gross material, like it's a bit more obvious. And then, so what is this fine material? I was just saying in my meditation, and then the body sort of disappeared, and then I could just feel, which most of us have, we just feel the energy. You just feel the energy of the body, and like a silhouette. But there was then I noticed that there was still pain. There was still pain in the body, so that was interesting. So even though the body, because we think, oh, it's because I've got a muscles or bones or this kind of this heavy thing that I'm lugging around, that's why I've got pain. But actually, even if the body is very subtle and very, fine, there is still pain. And so that was interesting, because that's what the Buddha says, like even the slightest of this existence is painful. So even in a supposedly other realm where there isn't much of a body, it's still painful. And so then I questioned, okay, so what is this body? And then the body started filling up. It started filling up to a point more than I thought my body would feel like, because, and then I realized I felt, okay, I felt fatter than I thought I was. And I realized that it's because I've been ignorant of most of my body. You know, I'm not fully aware of the extent of my body. We think we're aware of forever, but there are lots of parts of this body that we're not really fully aware of. Most of the time, we're just only aware of our heads. So suddenly I felt a lot fatter. And then what happened afterwards really made me connect with the suffering that the Buddha is talking about. And I felt very grateful for the Buddha for this teaching, because it was really horrific. So if you are very sensitive, you don't listen. So I felt I had this experience of the body being chopped in half. So from my forehead down to my pelvis. And then it doesn't end there. It got chopped this way, horizontally. And then it got stabbed with daggers, and the daggers stuck there. The daggers didn't come out. So it was like 100 daggers all over the body. So there was this chopped body and with daggers in it. And then it didn't stop there. More daggers came, and then it pierced my eyes. That was painful. And then pierced my throat. And then it started piercing all the organs, turning it, just fleshing it out, really. And it smelt of blood. And then they didn't stop there. So here I was, completely massacred, lots of daggers in me, blood pouring out. And then I was smashed around. The body was smashed around like you're in a boxing match, or even worse, like in a wrestling match, being thrown around. And then my skull was shattered. I was just thrown about. And oh my goodness, the amount of suffering I felt there was just enormous, that I felt, this is the amount of dukkha that I have endured over lifetimes. This body is so has had so much suffering. And then that night I saw a fetus that was supposed to be inside a mom's womb. The fetus was out there. And then I was helping people who were really, really manky. You know, I didn't even have any gloves, and I was helping these wounded people. And then you couldn't help them because they said, oh, there's no, we don't have the facilities to help them. So then they were dying, and it was so horrific. And the next day I was connecting with the dukkha, because this, I felt the amount of suffering this body has endured that we are not aware of. I've not even been stabbed once in this lifetime. I have not had a knife wound this lifetime. No one's really punched me. I don't think so. But there the Buddha was saying, look, this has happened to you. And after that, I remembered the sutta I had read. I forget the name, but I looked it up after, because Google is amazing. You just have to type two words that you think are vaguely related to it, and it comes up with the answer. So I put 100 Dagger Sutta. And so the sutta goes, the Buddha says, if you have been stabbed with 100 daggers, in the morning, and 100 daggers in the afternoon, and 100 daggers in the evening, every day for 100 years. So that's 300 times 100. And at the end of it, if you are guaranteed to realize the Four Noble Truths, he said he would take up that offer. He said, that's a good offer. And after that connection, I could really see, oh my goodness, yes, yeah. I mean, I've already been through that. We've already been through that amount of stabbing. So we don't really need to come back to experience it. We've already accepted that stabbing already. So now for all of us, it's such a precious opportunity, really, to go on this path. We've been offered the Four Noble Truths, by being here in this environment and coming to this Sangha. So take it. Don't waste this life away. And then we can get safely to Nibbana, to that peace. So say, there is an end to it. I'm not just telling this to you, the Buddha says, to this is the truth. It's because we forget. We die in the next life, we've forgotten, what happened in the last life. We have to be reminded. But the great thing to this teaching is that there is an end to it. We are told how we can, find a release from, what we've been talking about contemplating to see the reality, and so we get disenchanted, and then the heart will naturally let go. And when you're disenchanted, there is nothing to let go because, or when you see reality, there is nothing to let go because you wouldn't want it. Why would you want it? So you wouldn't be clinging in the first place. There is nothing to attach to. It just falls away. And then, like you were saying before, then there's nowhere to land because everywhere, as you see, is like that broken glass, which I've been told doesn't cut to you nowadays because of some technology. The broken glass in the shower room. There you go. Another trap of samsara. Think in the glass. It's not showing you suffering. But to end, I thought I'll read this. We should talk about Nibbana to complete the story. I really like this very short sutta, the reflection of the unconditioned. Because, like I said, if we have to contemplate both suffering and the third noble truth is the end of suffering, Nibbana. Because if you contemplated that, okay, there is something better, and I connected with it. It's more peaceful. So you let go, and when you're not in the right space. So this is the first discourse on Nibbana by the Buddha. It says Udana 8.1. So I'll read it slowly so you can close your eyes and receive it, contemplate. There is mendicants, that dimension where there is no earth, no water, no fire, no wind, no dimension of infinite space, no dimension of infinite consciousness, no dimension of nothingness, no dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. No this world, no other world, no moon or sun. There mendicants, I say, there is no coming or going or remaining or passing away or reappearing. It is not established, does not proceed, and has no support. Just this is the end of suffering. There is mendicants, that dimension where there is no earth, no water, no fire, no wind, No dimension of infinite space, no dimension of infinite consciousness, no dimension of nothingness, no dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. No this world, no other world, no moon or sun. Their mendicants, I say, there is no coming or going or remaining or passing away or reappearing. It is not established, does not proceed, and has no support. Just this is the end of suffering.